reason for the uncertainty in December is that I'm expecting to go to a conference, but I don't know what day we're presenting, so I don't know when I'm going to be gone and when I'm going to be coming back, but I'll be gone somewhere in there, and if I can make it to where we don't have to move it, we will. Okay. The September readings, you should now be 7 days into this, maybe 8 days into this, started with Ezekiel 46 or 47, and there's a powerful passage at the front end of Ezekiel 47. I want to just highlight something that was there so that if you want to go back and take another look at it, you might. Around chapter 40 in Ezekiel's vision, a man shows up and he has a measuring line and a measuring rod. And he goes all over the place for 6 or 7 chapters measuring everything in sight. Chapter 47 starts, he stops measuring, takes Ezekiel to the temple, and Ezekiel sees water flowing out of the temple. And the man walks him out 1,500 feet, roughly, and he says, walk across and walk back. And the man says, and Ezekiel says, when I did, it was up to my ankles. He takes him out another 1,500 yards or 1,500 meters or 1,500 whatever, and he says, walk across now, and the water was up to his knees. He does it a third time, another 1,500 units out, and the water's up to his waist. And the last time, another 1,500 out, he says, nobody could swim in that. And the question is, what does that represent? I heard somebody as I was coming in tonight saying, this book, Daniel, is a lot like Revelation. Well, so is Ezekiel in some parts of it. There's a lot of connection between these. What the meaning of this is not clear. One thing it could mean, and from my position I think it's likely it means, is this. Water is associated with the action and work of the Spirit. It's not an accident that during baptism the Spirit came down with Jesus. I don't think that was a coincidence. I think there's a connection between water and the Spirit. When the water is this deep and I can walk across it or wade across it, who's in control? I am. But when it gets so deep that the only way to go in is to just toss your life onto the water and let the water control, all of a sudden the control has shifted. And I think there's something being said about how far are you going in terms of giving the Spirit control of what you do and how far not. That's at least one of the things that people think is meant by that. I will also comment, if you go there, there's a very interesting thing. As he does this, as he finishes those four passages, the last one, when he tries to pass through the water, it's too deep to even swim in. The man who was with him, his guide through this, says, do you see, son of man? And I realized as I saw that, I do that all the time. I don't know that I'm necessarily a good teacher, but good teachers I've watched, they say some things, teach some things, work through some things, and then they stop, look at the pupil and say, do you see? And they don't necessarily mean vision of some object. They mean, have you been able to process and begin to pull meaning out of what has happened? That's the mark of a teacher there. And whoever the guide was, I think was a teacher. Daniel 4, I'm hitting some highlights across here. I think you've already read this part. King Nebuchadnezzar is humbled. He is put out into the field. He loses his mind. His fingernails grow. He ends up something like a beast of the field. And at the end of this, what happens? He acknowledges God. The most powerful man on earth is humbled by God for him to be able to get to the point where he recognizes and acknowledges who God is. Rather amazing little piece. Now, following quickly on that, Daniel had some dreams. One of his dreams was of four beasts. One of his dreams was of a ram and a goat. I think that may be about where you are right now. And it's interesting that a rough statement is provided from God as to what the meaning of this is. The beasts represent kingdoms in the future, probably coexisting in time. When he gets to the ram and the goat, he's talking about kingdoms that come probably in sequence to each other. Now, it's an appropriate moment as we're talking about that for me to say my intention is as we finish, and we're supposed to finish around 7:15, they say, or many of you will leave and I won't have anyone to talk to. Before we leave, I'm supposed to help you transition into the New Testament because that starts before this month is over. So I simply want to tell you about four things real quickly, and if there's time at the end, I'll tell you a couple more. One is, when the Bible ends with the book of Malachi for the Old Testament, when that when the Old Testament ends at Malachi, the world scene is totally different from the world scene when the New Testament starts, one page or two pages later in many Bibles. In that interim of time, the world powers that have existed when Malachi ends are gone. In their place has come another world power, Greece. And Greece is gone as a world power that wasn't even visible when the Old Testament ended. Rome has risen in power and has control of that part of the world that surrounds the Mediterranean basin. That transition is amazing, and the Bible is largely silent on that. The Catholic Church includes a few books in its translations that go into that interim period, but the books, the translations that evangelical Christians use usually do not include those books. The Apocrypha, if you've ever heard of that. So, in that period of time, there's been an upheaval and a change. There's a place in the New Testament that says, in the fullness of time, Jesus came. I think that phrase has a very specific meaning. Among other things, it meant this. When Jesus came, it was for the first time in hundreds, if not thousands of years, and the last time for at least hundreds, if not a couple of thousand years, that it was easy to move from one part of the known world to another, from one part of that world to another. A single power was in control of all of it. There were not borders, there were not guards, there were not checkpoints. All of that had been taken down with the Romans. It was free movement. There was a single language that almost everybody knew. That was Greek. There was a second language that many people used. That was Latin. But the Greek was the one where people who were teachers and people who were somewhat educated, they would all look. Single language, easy transportation. And within 100 years after Jesus' death, that all ended. And it wouldn't have existed more than maybe 50, 75, 100 years before his birth. There was something special about that moment. And so I want you just aware, part of that is probably what Daniel is talking about. The four kingdoms that existed at the same time, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and some others, were in that time period. The ram and the he-goat, probably Greece and then Rome in some order or another. And as you read that, obscure though that may be, you might think of that as telling you something about where the process goes, preparing for the time when Jesus is to come. Okay, back to this. They're skipping around a little bit. The treatment of Daniel 5 follows the treatment of Daniel 7 and 8. Daniel 5 is one you do need to read carefully. Belshazzar has a feast. He is the grandson or the great-grandson of the king who was humbled, who was sent out into the meadow losing his mind until he was ready to acknowledge God. His grandson has a drunken orgy. And in the middle of the drunken orgy, he says, "Weren't there some gold vessels that we took out of that temple in Jerusalem? Let's drink out of those." And they started making all kinds of statements to the idols that were around the room. And this chapter describes what that was like. Look especially at 5 verse 4. "They drank their wine and praised their idols of gold and silver, of bronze and iron, and of wood and stone." And then the next verse is when it suddenly becomes chilling. "Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and began to write on the plaster of the palace wall directly behind the lampstand. And the king could see the hand as it wrote. The king turned pale with alarm. His hip joints went slack, and his knees began to knock, frightened out of his wits." Come down to verse 23, I think it is. Daniel has come on the scene to help the king understand what has happened, and it's not good news. "You have defied the Lord of heaven. You have had the vessels from his temple brought to you. And you and your noblemen, your wives, and the women singing for you have drunk your wine out of them. You have praised gods of gold and silver, of bronze and iron, of wood and stone, which can neither see, nor hear, nor understand. But you have given no glory to the God in whose hands your breath itself and all of your fortunes are. That is why he has sent the hand which has written these words." He quotes the words and he says, "This is the meaning. God has measured your sovereignty and put an end to it. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided among the Medes and the Persians. That night, a group of people broke into the basement, the lower levels of the palace, came in, killed everybody in sight, and the kingdom changed that very night. And the king who replaced him is the one who said, it's time now, if the Jewish people want to go home, it's time for them to be able to go home. And the prophecy that was there would be exile for 70 years was fulfilled in part because of the things that happened that night. 2 Chronicles 36, I won't go there and read it, but 2 Chronicles 36, verse 22 and following, the new king Cyrus issues his proclamation, which says, if you're Jewish and you want to go home, go to it, and I'll try to give you some help to go home. Part of it was he wanted them to go and rebuild the temple, because he was acknowledging God. Look at the bookends around Belteshazzar. His grandfather acknowledged God. Cyrus acknowledges God. And Cyrus says, I think that temple needs to be rebuilt. He had probably heard the stories of that night and the finger writing on the wall. And so he said, go rebuild the temple. I'll send some folks with you. Much of the rest of what you'll read is going to go back and forth between the people still in exile and the ones who have begun to return. With what purpose? To rebuild the temple. But if you rebuild the temple, you got to rebuild the city that surrounds the temple. And if you rebuild the city that surrounds the temple, you got to repopulate it. And if you're going to repopulate it, that means you're repopulating the nation of Israel. You better do something to make sure that nation doesn't do what it did in the past. So all those four things you can see happening in what follows. Again, it's going back and forth between people still in exile and people who have begun to return. And you'll see that happening as you go back and forth. Now, at that point, they go through a bunch of psalms that talk about the theme of return. I commend those to your reading. But for tonight, I'm going to move on. We're going to move into Ezra, Nehemiah, and Haggai. Ezra, Nehemiah, and Haggai. You got a fighting chance of spelling Ezra and Nehemiah if you're taking notes. You're on your own for Haggai. There's a couple of G's and there's an A and an I and maybe another A. Put them where you think they fit. Haggai was a prophet who said in chapter 1, give careful thought to the circumstances you find yourselves in. You're thinking about yourselves and you're not thinking about me. You're thinking about your own designs and your own aims. You're not thinking about my word and what I've said I want to have happen. And things aren't going well for you. But as he goes on and begins to say, what you need to do is build a house for the Lord. That's rebuilding the temple. That's the wording you'll hear. About two chapters later, in chapter 2, verse 8, he says, in this place, and I believe he was talking about Jerusalem, I will grant peace. I'm not sure that that has been fulfilled yet. It's been partially fulfilled for a while, but I'm not sure it's been fulfilled in toto yet. They take you for a moment or two to Zechariah 1, where God says, return to me, and I'll return to you. He's essentially saying, the exile came not because I sent you away, but because I was acknowledging you had already left me. Now it's time for you to return to me. And I'll return to you. You can hear that if you think about the folks who took up the challenge of Cyrus to return. You could hear that as having special meaning for them. Zechariah became one of the people who led in that return and rebuilding process. So did Ezra. So did Nehemiah. In Zechariah, you'll see some more visions. You saw them in Daniel. You saw them in Ezekiel, or you will if you haven't. You're going to see some more in here. And each one of these, a horse or two running through myrtle trees, olive trees, and lampstands. In each one, God provides you with some meaning for that. It's either leaders that he's rising up or messengers that God is sending out into the world. In each case, he explains them. One of those in particular requires a little bit of comment. There's one around verse 10 of chapter 4 of Zechariah where he talks about a man with a measuring line. But a little bit later in several translations, that phrase measuring line is translated as plumb line, and there's a difference between the two. Measuring line is usually measuring a difference of some kind. What's a plumb line doing? Okay? It provides a measure. Is this wall perfectly straight up and down? I got somebody in the room who works construction. You build a building like this, it's supposed to be straight up and down, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. How do you know whether it is? Put a plumb line up against it. So you can almost hear God saying, you can't necessarily know whether you're meeting my standards unless you learn what my standards are and measure yourself against them, like one would measure whether a wall is straight with a plumb line. So that picture is in there. Okay. There's more in Zechariah, but we'll skip that for now in the interest of time. I want to take you back into these psalms. Remember I told you there were some psalms that were there? Among the psalms that they take you through, they'll take you for a little while into Psalm 118, 117, 119. And thereby hangs a very, very interesting piece of information which I'd like to share with you. This isn't, I think, part of the main thrust of what we're trying to do, but I think you may find this interesting. Most of you know, I hope, that when the Bible was written, nobody was saying, this is chapter 2, as opposed to that being chapter 3. And nobody was saying, this is verse 7, verse 8, as opposed to verse 9. The verse and chapter divisions came much, much later. They came in Europe much, much later to just help people find things in the Bible as the Bible was beginning to be given to the people rather than held by the clergy. All right. But if you take the chapter and verse divisions and you count all the verses in the Bible and you come back and find the one that's smack in the middle, it's an interesting verse. And so I'd like to take just a moment, show you where that verse is. Many of you have your Bibles with you. I'd like you to look for a moment at Psalm 117. This is not it. I'm getting you there. Just trust me. Look at Psalm 117. Tell me if you notice something interesting about Psalm 117.
Very short.
How short? Two verses. Shortest book in the whole of the Bible, Psalm 117. I'd like you to go to Psalm 119. How many verses there? 176. Many of you will be able to do this. If you're reading through the chronological Bible, it will do this for you. This is actually a book that is an alphabetical psalm. You ever seen books like that where they have the letter A and have a chapter or a page, and then the next chapter or the next section would have the letter B and stuff? Well, that's what this one does, and it does it in eight lines, eight verses per section, I think. So in my Bible, it's broken out into eight verse sections, and then there's a Hebrew word, a Hebrew letter next to each one. It's not the English alphabet now, it's the Hebrew alphabet, but it's an alphabetical hymn. 176 verses. It was in this sanctuary, the one just downstairs. One Sunday, we were in there. We had visiting musicians. The wife was at the piano playing. The husband was up at the podium. He was going to sing. She was going to accompany. And he said to the group that was assembled there for the worship service, this morning, we're going to sing a musical setting of the 119th Psalm. And across the room, about nine people, I was one of them, went, because I don't think there would have been time for the pastor to preach. At which point his wife leaned forward, and I realized they probably had practiced this, and she said, it's the 19th Psalm. And those nine people said, whew. Okay? Longest chapter in the whole of the Bible is Psalm 119. Shortest chapter in the whole of the Bible is 117. 118 is in between. The verse I spoke of is in chapter 118. And I almost think somehow there's a little signal pointing you to that. The particular verse is verse 8. Would you read it and tell me if that's an interesting verse to be at the center of the Bible? The central verse in the whole of the Bible. The middle verse, the one at the heart. Isn't that an interesting verse? If you don't have your Bible, let me read. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in human beings. Better to take refuge in the Lord than to rely on princes. That's not a bad verse for our age. Now, we were in Zechariah a moment or two ago. I want to make one more little connection here. Again, probably not all that important in the larger scheme of things, but boy, is it important in the detail. Zechariah 13, verse 1. Let me read. When that day comes, when that day comes. That's a phrase that has been used probably six or seven times earlier than this and it will be used after this. When that day comes, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to wash away sin and iniquity. Do you know the hymn, "There is a fountain filled with blood, drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains"? That's the same thing. That's the same thing. One of those places where I'm sure they're talking about Jesus. I wish I had an hour at this point. I don't. Because one of the things you will read this month is the book of Esther. And I think the book of Esther is written with two very, very different modes or themes. It is a compelling, engaging story. One of the best stories you'll ever read. And it makes a powerful point. Let me get the great story out of the way first. The king has another one of those drunken orgies. He's got 1,000 of his noblemen, and they're all half drunk. And he decides they need to see how pretty the queen is. And I think if you have an R-rated mind, you're probably hitting correctly what his plan was. He invited the queen to come in so that he could, and I'm quoting now, display her beauty to his 1,000 half-drunk noblemen. The queen refused. The king said to his nobleman, "What should I do?" And his nobleman made a fascinating response. "You are allowed to laugh. I know it's scripture, but you're allowed to laugh." They said, "You got to kick her out as queen, because if she gets away with this, every wife in the place is going to look at us and tell us not to do things when we're doing stupid stuff." I'm paraphrasing a little, but I'm not paraphrasing much. So he kicks her out as queen, decides he's going to get another queen, and the way he's going to get this queen, goes R-rated again for a moment, is he's going to have all the beautiful girls across the country rounded up, and he's going to bring them in one night, one apiece, one night for each. And when he finds the one he likes, that's the one going to be queen. In the meantime, there's an orphan girl, and her name is Esther. She has an uncle named Mordecai, and they're Jewish. And she's rounded up in this. And Mordecai has a sort of a middle management position in government, and he says to her, "Don't tell anybody you're Jewish." And she goes in, and she wins the contest. And she hasn't been queen very long when Mordecai overhears somebody plotting to assassinate the king. Quietly, he gets word to Esther. Quietly, Esther gets word to the king. The king looks into this, finds out it's true, has the people executed, and time goes on. Meanwhile, the king has one of his top advisors, one of his top lieutenants, a guy named Haman. And Haman gets on what my mother would call his high horse. He has elevated himself in power in the country, and he thinks that means he deserves glory, honor, and praise. And so he begins to expect everyone that he goes by to bow down and honor him. And there's one person who doesn't. That's Mordecai. His wife gives him good advice. "Why are you so upset? Everybody else is bowing to you. There's just this one guy. Don't worry about it." And he says, "I can't sleep. I can't eat." It's kind of stupid, right? And what he does is begins to plot not to kill Mordecai. He knows Mordecai is a Jew. He begins to plot to kill all the Jews everywhere. Word of this comes to Mordecai. Mordecai says to Esther, "Go to the king. Tell him what's going on." And she says, do you know the story of Esther enough to know what she says? What does she say? "He hadn't talked to me for several weeks, maybe a couple of months. I can't go in there uninvited, because if I go in there uninvited, what's going to happen? I get executed. Unless the king holds out his scepter to me, I'm going to die." Mordecai says, "Well, if the Jews are all killed, you're going to die too. Help will probably come from some other quarter, but you will have lost your chance." And she says, thinks about this a while. She says to Mordecai, "Have all the Jewish people pray. Purify themselves and pray for 3 days, and I'll go." And when she goes, the king is surprised to see her, and the king says, puts out his scepter to her so she's not killed, and says, "What do you want?" And instead of immediately saying, "Here's what Haman's doing," she says, "I'd like you to come and have a meal with me. And I'd like you to invite Haman to come along." Haman is just beside himself. It's wonderful. He's going to eat. Special invitation, eating with the king and queen. But meantime, he's still so frustrated about Mordecai. And his wife says, look, if you're that frustrated about it, why don't you just go have him executed? You've got that kind of power now. He said, that's a great idea. And I'm going to do it in a spectacular way. I'm going to build a gallows 75 feet tall and hang him on it. Interestingly enough, they built that gallows overnight. Do you know what you have to do to build a 75-foot tall gallows overnight? You have to hammer, 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 saw, saw, saw. Do you know what hammer, 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 saw, saw, saw does to the people who are trying to sleep nearby? Do you know? Keeps them awake. Among others that were kept awake was the king. King couldn't sleep. So he called his attendants and said, bring me something that I can read that will be guaranteed to put me to sleep. And they brought him the official records. He starts reading through the records and he comes across this little item. Mordecai sent word through the queen that I was going to be assassinated, and I looked into it and that didn't happen. And he walks outside to his attendants and says, what did we do to honor Mordecai? And the attendants said, nothing. And he says, call Haman. Haman comes rushing in, and the king says to Haman, what should the king do to honor someone that the king is pleased with and happy about? And Haman thinks, who could he be speaking of but me? And he begins to tell him what to do. And it is glorious, paraded through the streets with a high official walking in front. This is how the king honors someone with whom he is pleased. And the king says, that's great, go do that for Mordecai. You got to do what the king says, so he does. And when he's finished, he's more upset than ever. He goes to the banquet, and at the banquet, Esther's serving them food. The king says, listen, you didn't do this for nothing. Tell me what you want. She says, well, I do want something. What's that? I want you to come to another banquet tomorrow night. And when they come to the banquet the next night, she says to the king, I want you to save my people because somebody's trying to kill all of my people. Who would do such a thing? He says, him. And Haman is hanged on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai.
This is the Feast of Purim. This is what Jewish people still celebrate. They still celebrate this. Great story. The point is in the middle of it. Mordecai says to Esther, who knows but what you came to the position you have for such a day as this? Who knows? Ralph Vaughan Williams is an organist, music writer in England in years gone by, and he wrote a hymn which starts out, once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. For the truth or falsehood, which one will you decide? And goes on from there. It's talking about the same thing. Esther is a rollicking good story with a very, very strong point, and I hope you'll enjoy it when you get to it. I took too long, but it was too much fun. Okay, back to the returnees in Jerusalem. Back to the returnees in Jerusalem. We're going to look at Ezra. We're going to look at Nehemiah. I want to make sure before we leave this that you get one more little point. As you've gone through the Old Testament, have you noticed that every once in a while there's books that come in sets? 1 and 2 Samuel, did you notice that? 1 and 2 Kings? 1 and 2 Chronicles, remember that Chronicles was sort of covering the same thing Samuel and Kings covered? Okay, this is another two-volume set. The Jewish people, I'm told, who study the Old Testament would call this Ezra 1 and Ezra 2, not Ezra and Nehemiah as we do. First Ezra, Second Ezra would be the way they would name it. This is actually another two-volume set. And if you watch, Ezra and Nehemiah are there together. As you work through these two books, you'll see a common story being told. The story runs roughly in this order. They first rebuild the altar for the temple. Ezra then comes in, and somewhere around there they finish the temple, but the walls are not finished. And years have gone by without the walls being finished. You can't populate a city without walls to protect it and to control commerce and things of that sort. Nehemiah comes in to rebuild it. And he gets the walls rebuilt in 52 days. That's the outline of the story. Let me give you a few details as you're in there. Ezra was a rabbi scribe. He was one of the learned men, one of the people in the Jewish system who had great knowledge of Scripture. He led one delegation back, and the king gave him great resources, protection from armed soldiers, protection by armed soldiers from people who might not want him to be there, and lots of resources to do the work he needed to do. But as things went by, word that the walls hadn't been completed came to Nehemiah. Nehemiah's title doesn't sound like Ezra's title. He was the cupbearer to the king. He's the guy who poured the stuff that the king drank. But you got to understand, that's one of the most trusted positions that you could possibly have. Why? This is the last line of defense against poisoning. This has got to be, among your attendants, the most trusted one. Nehemiah went in one day, and he was almost crying. And the comments, if you read them carefully, tell you, crying in front of the king might make the king sad. That's a capital offense. You can get executed for that. Nehemiah's not supposed to do that. He's supposed to be up and happy and positive. And he let the king see that he was upset. The king asks him, "What are you upset about?" Instead of saying, "What are you doing upset? Off with you." He instead inquired as one would inquire of a friend, "What's wrong?" And Nehemiah pours out his heart to this king. Here's a king back here who was humbled. Here's a king here who was so profane and so contemptuous of God's things as to toast idols with those. Here's another king who comes in, recognizes God's blessings, and begins to help the Jewish people come back. Well, here's another king, Artaxerxes, in one translation. And he says to Nehemiah, "What's wrong?" as a friend would say to a friend. Nehemiah poured out his heart. "I've gotten word from Jerusalem. Things are not going well. The wall hasn't been rebuilt. They're at mercy of wild beasts. They're at mercy of bandits. It's not going well." King says, "What would you like to do about it?" Nehemiah says, "I'd like to go and help." And the king gives up his most trusted attendant and says, "Go. What do you need?" And Nehemiah begins to make a list of what he needs. He needs resources. He needs soldiers for protection. He needs letters of transit. He needs letters of authority. Everything he needs, the king gives him. And off he goes. And what you want to watch is you want to watch how these two very different people, one still almost fully immersed in the Jewish people in exile, the second one almost fully incorporated into the governmental system that oppressed them. These two working together lead the people. Let me hit a few highlights. There are more, but let me hit a few. Turn first to Ezra chapter 7. This is when Ezra's delegation is set up under the king's authority. Ezra chapter 8, there's a very interesting moment. Let me take those two places and see if I can show these to you. In my Bible, these are at the end of the history section, so they're back before Psalms and Proverbs. Ezra chapter 7. After these events in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, son of Seraiah, and then it lists all of his other ancestors, great-granddaddy, great-great-granddaddy, all the way back. "This Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a scribe versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given." Here's what I want to point out. What did the writer just say about Ezra? He said, "Ezra, he did this. He was this. He went there." If you know anything about English, that's third person, right? Get to Ezra chapter 7, verse 27. "Blessed be the Lord, the God of our ancestors, who moved the king's heart in this way to restore the beauty of the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, and won for me the faithful love of the king, his counselors, and all the most powerful of the king's officials. Taking heart, since the hand of the Lord my God was over me, I assembled those Israelites, heads of family, who were to go with me." Did you hear the switch to first person? Somebody's writing about Ezra up until the middle or end of chapter 7, and right at the very end of chapter 7, it switches to where Ezra starts to speak. It goes back and forth between those. A lot of the book of Nehemiah, it tells you about what Nehemiah did, but some significant sections, it says, "I, Nehemiah, did this, I, Nehemiah, did that." Okay? If you turn to Ezra chapter 9, he has arrived and he has found that among critical laws, that the people are ignoring is the law that says you should not intermarry with people who are not Jewish. And there is a prayer that comes. Verse chapter 9, verse 3. On hearing this, I tore my clothes. This is Ezra speaking. And my cloak, I pulled hair from my head and beard. I sat down in horror. All who trembled at the words of the God of Israel gathered around me when I was faced with the infidelity of the exiles. I went on sitting there in horror until the evening sacrifice. And at the evening sacrifice, I came out of my stupor, and falling on my knees in my torn clothes and cloak, I stretched out my hands to the Lord my God, and I said, the rest of the chapter is one of the most powerful prayers you'll see in the Old Testament. You get further into Nehemiah, you'll see a powerful prayer from Nehemiah. You go back into Daniel, you would have seen powerful prayers from Daniel. You'll have seen this in it. One of the things to watch for across this whole section is the prayers that people make. The confessions that they make, the acknowledgement that the harsh things that have happened to them were things that were just and right on God's part, and that they did not have any pleading of this wasn't fair. Their only pleading was, God, you have grace and you have mercy, and that's what we need. The prayers are powerful. Keep an eye out for those. Nehemiah chapter 1, the report comes that I told you about. They start back, and Nehemiah prays even before he goes to the king. Nehemiah's delegation was to rebuild the walls. There are a lot of commentators on the book of Nehemiah who say if you want to know anything about leadership, this is one of the best places to go. Books on leadership are selling like crazy in the bookstores across the country, and a lot of people say Nehemiah is still the best book on leadership. Let me read you a short list of a few of the things that pop up on that list. Chapter 2, verse 12. Before speaking, the leader takes his own look at things. He goes out in the middle of the night with almost no one with him. One guard goes with him, and he simply assesses where things are. Remember, his task was to rebuild the walls, so he begins to go out and look at what the job is like. Chapter 3, verse 1, he puts specific tasks in the hand of specific people, each one working in the place that they would have an interest in what happens there. They're working at their own house, or they're working in a house that someone else would eventually have or did have back before the exile took place. There was a connection between specific tasks to specific people, and therefore specific responsibilities, holding people accountable, and also having them work in their own self-interest. You get to chapter 4, he begins to make adjustments that would neutralize opposition and protect the effort from distraction. Chapter 5, the whole of that chapter is talking about how to stop plundering and profiteering. Anytime there's a war, somebody's going to try to make a buck off of it. And there were people who were doing that. The people who were hard at work rebuilding had so little money they were actually having to sell their children into slavery to some of these profiteers. Nehemiah puts a stop to that. That just gets you to chapter 5. It keeps going for a couple more chapters. It has been sitting there for decades, unbuilt, and the entire wall was built in 52 days. The entire wall was built in 52 days. Now, there are psalms that connect to these. Psalm 1 connects to that. Psalm 119, we've talked about already, connects to that. Psalm 121 connects to that. Let me take you to Psalm 121. You can look at the others as well sometime. I think I must have heard this psalm read in one translation or another 6 or 8 dozen times. And I'm not sure I yet have heard anybody read it correctly. So at least once, let's all of us read this psalm correctly. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Stop. New thought. A question. Where is my help going to come from? End of question. Answer to the question. My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. When most people read this, they read it as if the help is going to come from the mountains. That's not what it's saying. I lift up my eyes to the mountains, and I begin to think, I need help, and where's it going to come from? And then the thought comes, it's going to come from God. And the rest of that psalm begins to explicate this. My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. May He save your foot from stumbling. May He, your guardian, not fall asleep. For you see that He neither sleeps nor slumbers, the guardian of Israel. The Lord is your guardian, your shade, the Lord at your right hand. By day the sun will not strike you, nor the moon by night. The Lord guards you from all harm. He guards your life. He guards your coming in. He guards your going out, henceforth and forever. Psalm 136 is a second interesting psalm. This is one we ought to read. I don't think we will, but just look at it very quickly. Do you notice anything interesting in Psalm 136? The second half of every verse is exactly the same. Do you know why? This is to be read responsively by people who don't have a book to hold. So the reader reads the first line of each verse, and the people in the room repeat the second. And the word that they repeat, give thanks to the Lord for he is good. And the group says, for his faithful love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of gods for his faithful love endures forever. That phrase, faithful love, is the Hebrew word hesed, H-E-S-E-D. And it is probably one of the two or three most powerful words. It talks in a way that is paralleled in the New Testament by the word grace and mercy. Somehow all tied up in one. And over again, the people are taught to recognize his faithful love endures forever. Okay. Now, back to Nehemiah, back to Ezra. I want you to see something here. Chapter 7 of Nehemiah. How are we doing on time? I think we're kind of doing okay. Nehemiah chapter 7. I said it was Nehemiah 7, but I think it may be Ezra 7. Nope. Okay, it's Nehemiah 8. I said Nehemiah 7, it's Nehemiah 8. He's been there a little while. Nehemiah's been there a little while. Ezra's been there longer. When the seventh month came around, the Israelites being in their town, that was the last phrase in chapter 7, verse 8, chapter 8, verse 1. All the people gathered together as one person in the square in front of the water gate and asked the scribe Ezra to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had prescribed for Israel. On the first day of the seventh month, the priest Ezra brought the law before the assembly, consisting of men and women and all of those old enough to understand. Who are those? Those are the kids, but not the babies. In the square in front of the water gate, and in the presence of these men and women, and of those old enough to understand, he read from the book from dawn until noon, and all the people listened attentively to the book of the law. Says in verse 8, a very powerful thing. Ezra read from the book of the law, translating and giving the sense so that what he read was understood. Then His Excellency Nehemiah and the priest scribe Ezra and the Levites who were instructing all the people said to the people, today is sacred to the Lord your God. Do not be mournful. Do not weep. Why did they say that? Look at the next sentence. For the people were all in tears as they listened to the words of the law. The people had gathered in humility. They heard the law read to them. They began to line up what their conduct had been against this, and they realized we are wrong, and they began to weep in humility. They began to be sorry for their sins. They were confessing, and they were repenting. They were having a revival service. Verse 10. Ezra then said, you may go, eat what is rich, drink what is sweet, and send a helping to the man who has nothing prepared, for today is sacred to our Lord. Do not be sad. The joy of the Lord is your stronghold. And the Levites calmed all the people down, saying, quiet down, be calm. This is a sacred day. Do not be sad. And all the people went off to eat and drink and give helpings away and enjoy themselves to the full, since they had understood the meaning of what had been proclaimed to them. Joy is found when you align yourself with the Lord. And that's what the people had done. Now,
I want you to notice a celebration that starts in Nehemiah chapter 12. There's a history lesson that comes in the meantime. There's a repopulation of Jerusalem. People don't want to live there. It's a dangerous place. It's not really ready to service the folks, but they do that. But in any event, they finally do all of that. And in chapter 12, around verse 27, they have a dedication ceremony for the wall having been rebuilt. Okay? And I want you to take a look at verse 31 for a moment. This is for those people who sing in choirs or have ever sung in choirs. Verse 31 says, this is Nehemiah speaking, I made the leaders of Judah come to the top of the wall and appointed two large choirs. One made its way along the top of the wall to the right. And then verse 38, the other choir made its way along to the left. What's he doing? Those of you who have ever heard choirs sing, he's building an antiphonal choir. He's got two groups to sing back and forth. One speaks to the other, one speaks to the other. Back and forth the music goes. The celebration goes. Now, I want to take you to something at the end of this, but I don't want to take you there first. There was a celebration for the rebuilding of the altar way back in Ezra 3, and I want you to go back there for just a moment. Ezra chapter 3. Verse 3, they erected the altar on its old site. Verse 10, the builders laid the foundations of the temple of the Lord, and when they had done so, the priests in their robes stood forward with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord according to the ordinances of David, the king of Israel. They chanted praise and thanksgiving to the Lord, because for Israel, they said, he is good and everlasting in, here's that phrase again, his faithful love. Now, I want you to contrast what you read here with what you're going to read back in Nehemiah 12. This is the first celebration. What they're celebrating is they've rebuilt the altar and they've rebuilt the foundations of the temple. The full building of the temple will come later. And they're pausing and having a celebration. That was a good thing to do. But here's what they said. All the people, this is verse 11, all the people raised a mighty shout of praise to the Lord since the foundations of the temple of the Lord had now been raised. Now listen carefully. Many of the older priests, Levites, and heads of family who had seen the first temple wept loudly when the foundations of this one were laid before their eyes. But many others, who would they be? The younger ones who hadn't seen the original temple. Remember, they've been in exile for at least 70 years plus whatever time it took to come back. Many others shouted aloud for joy, so that no one could distinguish the noise of the joyful shout from the noise of the people's weeping, though the people did shout so loudly that the noise could be heard from far away. Nehemiah chapter 12. Nehemiah chapter 12. Verse 31, the first choir goes left. Goes right. Verse 38, the next choir goes to the left. Verse 41, they finish singing. They take their place in the temple of the Lord. Verse 42, after naming all the people who were with him, the singers sang loudly under the direction of it. Names the choir director. Those of you who know Paul Honaker may recognize the importance of this. They named the choir director. There were great sacrifices offered that day, and the people rejoiced. Watch what's coming. God having given them good cause for rejoicing. The women and children rejoiced too. Who was rejoicing last time? Half of them. And the other half were weeping because of what had been lost. What's happening now? Everybody is rejoicing. They're all lined up together in joy, right? The women and the children rejoiced too. And the joy of Jerusalem could be heard from far away. Both times, what was happening could be heard from far away. One time it came through as noise. The second time it came through as joy. What was the difference? The people are aligned. The people are aligned. And they are aligned along the axis of joy, not on the axis of grief. Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. When you get there, what you find is a dialogue between God and his people. God says something, the people take issue with it, and God begins to explain at length why he said what he did and why it's true. God is essentially judging.
The people question that judgment, and God gives the basis of his judgment. And the judgment is not often very good. What were the things he talked about? Walk through the book of Malachi. Here's a few things you'll hear God speaking about. He'll speak about the reality of his love for his people, because the people are questioning whether he loves them. He's going to speak of the contempt people have for God. He's going to speak of the hollowness of the sacrifices people offer to God. He's going to speak of the failure of the priests to lead people to God. He's going to speak of his view of divorce. He's going to speak of the failure of the people to align themselves with his justice. He's going to speak of the way people rob God by holding the blessings of God for themselves. He talks in here a bit about, you come to offer for sacrifices, you've got a governor over you, you're still under the control of a foreign power. Why don't you go try to give some of the animals to them that you're trying to sacrifice to me? See what they say. You're offering me shoddy gifts that you know are worthless just to have something to do. And finally, he talks about the fact that the day is coming when God will judge. And that's the end of the Old Testament. You'll have about 3 days of reading in the New Testament. In that 3 days, you will learn of John the Baptist. You will learn of Jesus and their births. You will find that they are cousins. You'll learn something about the connection between them. And you'll get far enough to see John the Baptist beginning his work, and you will end. Okay? Now, according to that clock, I've got 5 minutes. I've already told you something about the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament. I want to try to get you started thinking about what you're going to read, because the first thing you're going to be reading are the Gospels. In the New Testament, there's the Gospels. There's one book of history. That's the book of Acts. If you're really careful and notice, you might notice that Acts is volume 2 and Luke is volume 1 of a 2-volume set. They're not going to tell you this. But if you look at the first 4 verses of Luke and the first 4 verses of Acts, you'll see this. And here's something I think would be helpful for you to know. The book of Matthew, as far as we know, was recorded, written down by Matthew, one of Jesus' disciples. That disciple was a tax collector before he became a disciple. As you read through Matthew, watch. It only happens a couple of times, but tax collectors become the subject of something Jesus is talking about. Listen for those moments, because those are moments where Matthew is speaking as a tax collector, listening to what Jesus has to say about tax collectors. One of Jesus' disciples, Matthew, brought you that book. The second book is Mark. Mark wasn't one of Jesus' disciples, but Mark was a close relative of Peter. And many people believe, if you want to see the Gospel of Mark correctly, see the Gospel of Mark as being Peter's version of things. It's probably not an accident that Mark is very simple. It's very straightforward. Some of you are old enough to know Jack Webb. Some of you are old enough to know the television show he made popular. Are you? Do you? What was Jack Webb's tagline? Just the facts, man. That's the book of Mark. That's the book of Mark. This happened, and at once this happened. And then this happened, and at once this happened. And at once, it just says, this happened, this happened, this happened. It's just laid out for you. Just the facts, man. That's not quite right, but it's close enough to write that it'll do for tonight. And many people believe that book was influenced strongly by Peter. So that if you want to see that book as maybe coming in some way from Peter, probably you're seeing that correctly. The book of Luke. Luke wasn't a disciple, but Luke was a companion of Paul during Paul's missionary journey. And many people believe when you read the book of Luke, and maybe when you read the book of Acts, you're seeing a lot of influence from Paul. Paul, you may remember, was one of the great Bible scholars of the time. He was one of the great scholars of the Old Testament. He ended up going out in the desert for 3 years to try to figure out how he had been such a student of the Old Testament, still got everything so wrong. It's interesting for me to have that thought. Is it possible that people can study the Bible and study the Bible and study the Bible and still get everything wrong? There's an example right in the Bible itself. So, the book of Luke, the book of Acts, strongly influenced by Paul, and strongly influenced by Paul having gotten it so wrong and then doing everything he could to try to help you see it right. John, we think, was probably the youngest of Jesus' disciples. In that book, when he speaks of himself, he simply says, "I am the disciple that Jesus loved." Many people think he was a teenager, maybe an early teenager. And he lived, we think, into his 90s. So when he wrote Revelation to talk about his experiences and his visions that God had given him, this was an elder statesman who had been at one time one of the young ones. So when the book of John was written, it was written by that disciple. So those are the ones who influenced it. Now let me come back and walk through them again. The book of Matthew was written, we believe, primarily to give the Jews a sense of how Jesus fulfilled all the prophecies and was the Messiah that the Jewish prophets had foretold. The connections back to the Old Testament, the references back to the Old Testament, much more numerous in Matthew than any of the other three Gospels. You come to the book of Mark. Mark looks like it was probably written for the Romans. The Romans were sort of straight ahead, brutal folks, didn't have a whole lot of time to think about a whole lot of stuff because they were doing so much. And the book of Mark seems to have been a book written more for those. The book of Luke appears to have been written for the Greek, for the educated, the ones who, I told you a while ago, had that universal language of the educated people. Luke was written for that group. John was written for everybody. Let's come back now and make one more pass through. Jesus is God's Messiah. That's the message here in Matthew. You move to Luke. Jesus is fully human. That's the heart of Luke. The stories that they tell in Luke, the parables that you will read in Luke, bring out Jesus' humanity. You get to the book of John, and John is saying, okay, you've got the first three Gospels, but there's a piece missing. I want you to understand that Jesus is fully God. Not denying anything that Luke said of Jesus being fully human, but making sure you understand that Jesus is fully divine. I've got one more big thing to say, but I think it will wait. I commend to you the reading that you have to do. God bless you as you do it, and I'll see you about a month from now.